Hi, I'm Keith.
Hi, this is Ragini.
And welcome to More Than Masala, a podcast where a chef and a culinary researcher talk about spices from the Indian subcontinent, from how to use them to sometimes the dark history behind their origins. Every episode, Ragini and I do a deep dive into one spice and talk about the history as well as how to use the spice. This is Off Script with Keith and Ragini, and you know, what you hear is what you're going to get. This is us just off script, asking each other questions, telling stories that we love, and we are still hanging out at my house in Milford, New Hampshire, which is like, it's a pretty small place, huh?
Yep, it's a pretty small place.
Ragini's staying at this Airbnb, and it's like, you know, 12-minute drive, and so she's like, oh, how far is it? I was like, oh, it's right down the road.
For someone who lives in a city, this is not right down the road. It's through like a few miles of hills, and like, it's gorgeous, but it's not right down the road, so.
It's right down the road.
I expected to be able to walk to Keith's house, and it's not the case.
I mean, you could, but you'd probably be sore throughout the course of it. Like, it's a heck of a walk.
I also probably couldn't walk there and back in the same day.
Yeah, no dying, Ragini. So Off Script is kind of fun. It's this thing that we thought of to try to get listeners to understand who we are more. Ragini is clearly the spice guru, and you know, she always hates when I call her guru.
Yes, she does.
But she is a fantastic and brilliant human being who I have had the privilege and honor of getting to know more and more. So I wanted to kind of just start by asking you a couple of questions and then vice versa. So nonstop. Ready?
Let's do it.
Are you nervous?
Nope.
She's a little nervous. All right. So question one. If you didn't do food research, if you didn't have all of this knowledge and this passion for food, what would you do as a career? And you can't say this career that you have currently.
So for those of you who don't know, my like full-time career is in education. And I've been trying to, I've been trying to move it over to food full-time for a little while now. But if food wasn't, I think I came to food in a way where I was like, this is just what I need to do because it's so exciting to me. And education was that way to me like 12, 15 years ago. But I think food is something that I hadn't really considered professionally because it was a hobby that I loved so much. And so I didn't really want to make it a career when I'm thinking about like F&B industry type stuff. And then when I like sort of discovered for myself the world of food research and like this kind of very niche space in food that I'm interested in, I'm excited to kind of build that out as, you know, as a career. But if it wasn't that, I think I would be a primary school teacher.
Primary school. So it's teaching. It's the teaching. Scarlet thread.
Yeah.
And now you're teaching the bazillions of people who listen to this podcast, right?
Bazillions.
That is an accurate count. Second question. And again, this is off script with Keith and Ricky. I can't even say my name. See, there's no edits. It's just what we do. Off script. With Keith and Ragini. Or Ragini and Keith. I think that sounds better.
That will sound good.
Here's my random off the cuff question. If you had one meal that you knew that you had to have for the rest of your life, these are tough and these are not fair questions. What would it be and why?
So for those of you who know me, I hate questions that make me choose one thing. And the only other thing I really dislike is eating the same thing over and over again. So
maybe I sort of knew some of this.
God, how do I... One meal. You know, if I... you have not defined this clearly enough, so I'm going to take advantage of your loophole. If I had to have one meal for the rest of my life, it would be dim sum. See what I did?
I do, because it's like the pizza question. Like, you didn't say toppings.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So it'd be dim sum. Yeah, I think that'd be my one meal.
Clever. Okay, last off-the-cuff question that I think is probably important. Let's say this. What is one project that you really want to do in the next year that you think would help evoke kind of the passion that, you know, that you have in you, really kind of, because you're obviously a person who's very knowledgeable and passionate. What is one project that you really hope to accomplish in the next year?
So I think for me, one of the things I am doing is to Desi from Desh. And the reason that I'm doing that personally is because I wanted to go on this journey with everyone who's on the program and like looking at the Indian diaspora in order to consolidate that information so that we represent it as a journey. And I think that that's really important because all of our stories are super connected. And I think coming like to our podcast and looking at food and spices, it's the same kind of idea where everything is, it's connected, and it's artificial for us to be like, this is an Indian spice and this is a Yemeni spice and this is a Pakistani spice. And you know, like that's just not how the world works. And for us to go back to a world where that was the case, we'd have to go back thousands and thousands of years. So we might as well accept that we live in this very sort of naturally multicultural and pluralistic way, whether or not we know it. And so I think for me, what would be really cool is to have a project potentially in the form of a book where that's what we do. We look at each spice and we talk about, you know, we talk about the story of it, not, you know, not for one cuisine, but, you know, as human beings, one of the things that's crazy is like, we think we're so different from one another. And you and I have talked a lot about this last couple of days, is that everyone is kind of the same. And not just that, but the world has kind of moved at a similar pace. Right. So when we talk about any technological development from, you know, clay to the internet, the world in varying degrees, the world has more or less had access to it within a 50-year span, which seems long for one person's lifetime, but is not really long in the story of the world. And so I think even with spices and how to use them, it's the same kind of thing. Like it's, you know, people discover things kind of around the same time, and it makes its way around the world. And so I think that's an important story to tell. But this is a good time for me to flip it on you.
Well, I got a quick bonus question. Can I do this one?
Sure.
And then we can talk about me.
Okay.
What are three just simple, quick facts that blow your mind about spices?
So the first fact is that there's so little written about how they moved from place to place, but they literally form the basis of world trade. So if you look at all, like, you know, why did the Portuguese set out? Why did Christopher Columbus set out? Like, why did the British set out? Why did the Dutch set out? It's all spices like that. You know, it was those riches that kind of made and broke empires. So that's one fact that just kind of blows my mind. And I keep saying, for those of you who've been listening to the podcast, I keep saying spices are the quiet heroes of history. And I truly believe that because they're so important and they're so much a part of every home and every day and every single meal. And there's so little about how they got to certain places. Like, we know the major ones, like, oh, so-and-so bought this plantation, but they've moved so much more than that. So that's one fact that blows my mind. I think the second is, there's interesting facts about various spices. You know, salt was used for celery. Pepper was so valuable. It was used, when the Roman Empire fell, you know, so on and so forth. Like there's these like specific, interesting moments in history that we have with each spice. But I think if I were to kind of step back, one interesting thing, if you're looking at trends, is if we look at the West and the East, which is often how we like contextualize certain foods. And when we talk about the West, you know, we're talking very often about like a Franco-Anglo food culture, you know, predominantly a Franco-Anglo food culture. And you don't see a lot of use of spices in the way that you do in the East. You see a lot more herbs, you see a lot of aromatics, so on and so forth, aromatics by way of herbs, but not so much like aromatic spices. Or you see, you know, certain things like cinnamon that's largely used in sweeter dishes and not in savory and things like that. But if you go a little bit back in time, you see, but then that is at odds with the fact that I've just said that spices are why all of that colonialism happened. So that those two facts don't make sense together. Right. And so I think what blows my mind is that that went through this time in history where the elite had spices, so their stews were very rich and, you know, full of spices, so on and so forth. And then as they started to become more and more accessible to the general public, the elite started to pare back on the spices and started to focus way more on the produce, way more on, you know, the the produce, you know, like how things look and feel and taste, and not doing too much or focusing on, you know, the French sort of haute cuisine, like that kind of develops around that time. And so now we have a world where people are relearning spices from the West, and they're seen in kind of a different light. And I just wonder, like, had that not happened, you know, what would world cuisine have been like? Mm-hmm. Like that. Sorry, I'm giving long answers to these facts, but these are things that actually blow my mind, because I'm like, that's crazy, right? Like, for people to be having capsules of turmeric when, like, maybe 8 or 9, 10 generations ago, they were blooming turmeric in fat and having it in their food, and we don't know that, right? So that's two. The third thing that blows my mind is one of the ways in which we often talk about spices is traditionally this is how it was done, or we assume that things kind of happened organically all the time. But if you look, and I'm going to take a particularly subcontinental lens for this particular fact, if you look at just the number of ways in which spices are used, I can't help but think there were people tasked to do this. Because you can't record that kind of information, even if it's like oral transmission from, you know, generation to generation to generation, but so many people have the same knowledge. So, like, it has to have been established, right? And we have Ayurveda texts and we have other medical texts, but I think there must have been at some point in time these, like, you know, laboratories of some sort where people were figuring out, what do we do with spices? Like, these things were poison for plants, and we figured out that, like, hey, they taste really good and they don't kill us as humans, right? And they're actually good for us. So that blows my mind, is that we just have no, very, very little insight as to how people figured out what to do with spices.
That is awesome. And that's why we asked that question.
All right, over to you. So my first question for you, and I'm going to give it a little bit of preamble to this, is one of the things that I really appreciate about what you do is that you are obviously a professional chef who has years and years of experience with food. And the other day when I was chopping an onion in front of you, I kept, like, glancing over because I was so worried about how you would judge me chopping that onion. But but one of the things I really appreciate about you is the kind of effort that you put into your learning of especially subcontinental food at the moment, and not just the kind of effort you put into it, but your acknowledgement of the depth of learning that you want to get to before you, like, you know, go forward and kind of take that forward. So I guess my first question to you is, what do you think the next step in your learning is?
Well, first of all, thank you. Means a lot when the people that you look up to say things like that. I think part of it is to spend a good amount of time in India. Mm-hmm. I feel like, so my friend Tarun, when we first started hanging out, I would cook him some dishes and he'd be like, this is really, really good. He's like, how do you get a reference point for that? And I never really thought of that. I don't actually have reference points. I feel like I have a decent knowledge of a lot of regional cuisine when it comes to the subcontinent. I certainly study this a lot. you definitely understand that. But I don't have a reference point. Having never been to India, I can't tell you what it's like to stand at a street stall eating pav bhaji. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't tell you the scents in the air, the sounds, the smells. I can't tell you the humidity in the air. These are things that are easy to romanticize, but in the chef world, we call these things flavor memories, right? Where we'll take something, whether it's like, you know, I'll do something that I can really easily to. In the fall, since I live in New England, you can see the apples that are completely perfect and ready to go. And you walk over to the branch, you twist the apple and you tug, and it makes this crack sound. And then the minute you bite into an apple that is perfectly ripe, there's this splash that happens. It's not overly juicy like a peach, but it's this crisp crunch mm-hmm. followed by a spritz of aromatic apple essence. And that's a beautiful thing.
I literally like tasted an apple as you said that.
And I need to have that when it comes to food from the subcontinent. And so I think part of it is that. I think the other thing is sometimes I feel crazy if I'm being very vulnerable and honest, because like I'm really working hard on my Hindi. I'm really working hard on the history. And a lot of people will ask me, well, you're a chef. Why do you need to know this? And I just stop and I say, like, this cuisine is rooted in history. Like, America is not that old. We're still the new kid on the block in a lot of ways. When you think of, sure, you look at independence in 47, but when you look at the thousands of years before this, I can't do it even remote justice without understanding the why. And in the culinary world, we focus a lot on technique. Well, technique is the why this dish tastes so good. With food from the subcontinent, there's so many different techniques that you don't learn in Western cuisine. And those are the whys. Once you understand the why, then there's this great phrase. It's like, learn the rules like a student so that you can break them like an artist. And that's kind of how I feel at this journey. So I need to go to India. I need to continue learning history, Hindi. I need to continue speaking to people from all regions of India and the subcontinent, not just Bombay and Delhi. God bless Bombay and Delhi. I absolutely have so much love. But I want to know what's happening in Assam. I want to know what's happening in remote regions, villages, and from all different types of people and classes as well.
That's awesome. And I think that's that question of answering, or that motivation to understand why a cuisine is the way it is, makes the food so much richer. And I think one of the things that people have really come to appreciate more recently than we saw in the 80s and 90s is how understanding where something comes from enriches the experience of the meal.
Yep.
Right.
Absolutely. So, I feel like a lot of it is now experiential based, mm-hmm. right? What I get to do at Atma is not just deliver food that I'm proud of and that I think many people are proud of, but I get to explain why. I get to explain the science behind the spices, but also the art behind the spices. Mm-hmm. I didn't invent Indian cuisine. It was around before my great, 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 great grandfather. All I'm doing is I'm hopefully at my best, I'm a vessel.
So what is, okay, so you learn all of this stuff, you get into the history, and then what? Where does Chef Keith go from there?
These are hard questions, because in the culinary world, the path is pretty linear. Mm-hmm. Go to school for culinary, get out, get job, work your way up from commis to all the way through sous chef and executive chef, open your own restaurant, receive glory, you know? And I think that linear path sets a lot of people up for failure on multiple different levels. I think this ends in a dining experience, in a dining journey. We call the pop-up Atma because it is the truest expression of myself at this point. I think it leads to a restaurant. I think it leads to deeper exploration. I don't know. The best way I can answer it is I don't know. And I don't know if it ever ends. And if I'm lucky, it never does.
What was one dish from, or can you describe one of the dishes from the last Atma menu and tell us what that represented for you and why that was important?
Sure. So the first dish on the last Atma menu was called Shukriya Teraji. And Shukriya, obviously, the Urdu word for thanks. I get that right?
Yeah.
Look at that. Nailed it. No. So the reason it's thank you, Tara, Tara is Tarun's mom, and we were coming back from a business meeting one day, and it was like a long drive, and Tarun's mom was like, texted Tarun and was like, hey, tell Keith that I made lunch. And first of all, if you have never had that experience where this wonderful lady makes you lunch, who A, knows how to cook, and she could be sitting here being like, oh, I'm okay, Tarun's better, you know, it's because she loves her son.
But no, she's, after having eaten one of her meals, she is incredible.
Really?
Like a whiz.
And you know, like that meal tastes like home. It tastes like love. It's like these things that are just really hard to recreate as chefs when we turn out large amounts of food. So ended up stopping there, and she had dosa, idli, sambar, and Tarun made coconut chutney. And we went on this huge food experience, you know, as that business trip. And when we came back, he made these, the little mini idlis, the midlis. Mm-hmm. And he was like, you know, we eat these as kids, you know, to try to get them to eat their idli. And I was dunking it in sambar, and I had this moment where, like, to be honest, like, I started getting emotional, like, my eyes welled up. And I felt this deep sense of, like, love and gratitude. And it's funny telling the story because I can feel it now. Like, this deep sense of love and gratitude that these people cared so much for me, that they were just doing something that to them is commonplace, right? Mm-hmm. It's just, it's what you do. It's that guest is God kind of concept. But I'm not a guest anymore, you know? I'm just this person who really, like, is passionate. And every bite, I was just like, how the heck is this so good? I know conceptually how to do dosa. My dosas are okay. Mm-hmm. But I've made dosa a lot. I know how to do sambar. But yet, the best sambar in the world is the one that one makes for you. And so I thought of that moment, and I realized the next day when I started planning the menu that I wanted to share that story. And so it was my thank you for that moment, because there's a lot of times we look back and our loved ones pass and we don't get those anymore. I can remember my mom and the scrambled eggs that she used to make. I make better scrambled eggs, but I also don't make better scrambled eggs than her. So yeah, that was one really great moment.
That's awesome. So for those of you listening, Keith may look like a tough guy, but he's just a big softy.
Don't give away my secrets. Yeah, it's a fun exploration. Let's turn it back to you. Dun dun dun.
Dun dun dun. Dun.
We, for those of you listening, we have spent the last 3-4 days together, and we go on these epic rants. Some of them, I'm glad they're not recorded.
most of them.
Because I think we develop opinions, but I want to get into some of those opinions. So you did an amazing piece recently that you showed me on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk a little bit about your research in general when it comes to Indian cuisine and food from the subcontinent. Tell me some of the things that present a challenge for you as a food researcher, things that may be difficult topics to approach. And I'm asking you this question as just like a white guy from the West. Talk to me a little bit about some of the challenges that you have in your research, and how we think we can approach those in a healthy conversational piece.
Ooh, that's quite a question.
I tried to be as PC as possible.
So when I started with Third Culture Cooks, I started with something that was a difficult conversation, right? I started with something that was, I started with Bordered, which was my supper club series that looked at geopolitical conflict, which at its very core is uncomfortable. And my research, and the reason that I'm telling the story first is because I think it shaped how I look at food at all. Because when I started doing the research for this, I didn't really have an end goal in mind. And so I lived in London at the time, and I was able to spend time with people from different parts of the world in the closest thing to their context outside of their context, right? Because London is the city, is a city that has like the markets, it has the communities, it has the languages and all that stuff. And so I think like there were a few people who really shaped that experience by telling me how what they ate changed when they became refugees, how what they missed, what they integrated into their cuisine. And that's when I started thinking about this. Now, my family's history is like deeply rooted in the partition of India and Pakistan. But I hadn't really asked the question of what did that do for how we ate up until, you know, 7 years ago. I'd heard stories ad nauseum from when I was a child. So it was a very close story to my heart. But as I started looking at, okay, what did that do for how we ate? That was when I realized things like why, you know, I say zira and you say jira. Like I realized why that was, you know, it came from that kind of research. It came from like, oh, okay, our food was from the west of Punjab and this is how it was different. And then exploring how cities like Delhi, which is now where my family is from, essentially, how cities like Delhi and cities like Lahore, how their identity around food changed. And a lot of that has to do with religion, because that was kind of the basis of the story of partition, right? And as a quick tangent, I had this very, I think I've told you the story before, where I had somebody at one of my Punjab dinners whose grandparents went the other way from India into Pakistan and had a much more, had quite a brutal experience of having done that. And it was, you know, there was various things over the dinner. And she was, to my mind, I was a bit intimidated by her because it wasn't, it was confrontational almost at some points. But at the end of the dinner, she came to me and said, thank you, because not only have I never interacted with a Hindu before, but I've never not hated a Hindu before.
Oh, wow. That's powerful.
And it just, it broke me inside, because I was like, oh my God, like we are two generations away from partition. And I've, you know, we've seen it in our families. I think people can respond in different ways to it, but like we've seen what that did. And it was food that allowed us to come and have that conversation, you know? And so like that, when I, and then I started, you know, that was a little bit more international in its focus. But over the years, my research has veered further and further towards the subcontinent and towards the sort of trade routes that go through the subcontinent. And I think one of the things that, you know, whether I'm looking at the diaspora or I'm looking at India, you inevitably come up against both religion and caste. And caste for me came up actually, it came up in research. And then I remember as I started, when I moved to India and I started following more people in India and started kind of tapping into the world of Instagram there a few years ago, I noticed a lot of food from communities, and it would have the name of their caste in the name of the community, right? And now I don't begrudge people that one bit, but it did make me uncomfortable because I felt like it was an assertion. And it happened kind of organically, where I kept seeing it again and again and again. And I was like, oh, like that's an interesting like thing to keep seeing. And so I think that has been something that's been really interesting for me to watch, especially in the subcontinental food space. And it's kind of across religions. It's more pronounced in Hinduism, but it's across all religions on the subcontinent, is how mainstream food is very, very upper caste, both in terms of access, in terms of the way we talk about it, frankly, in terms of the way it's celebrated as like a community's food. And I understand at this point it's thousands of years of identity and they're so intertwined. I get all of that. But I think the direction that I'm going in is more and more one of acknowledgement, and it's been uncomfortable for me. Like I've had to look at my own family's food and be like, oh, this is why we had access to this. Oh, this is why we eat this.
And I just wanted to jump in for 2 seconds. One of the things that I appreciate about you and having conversations like this, which are clearly, if somebody's listening and feels anger or pain throughout the course of this, you're not, and you never have, even in when we're just talking, you've never demonized somebody because of a caste. You've never looked down. You've never thrown prejudice at this. I think one of the things that you've always, and you've taught me this too, is to have an understanding for it. You know what I mean?
That's very kind. I'm glad I come off as mature as that. It sounds very mature, but no. I think the thing is, like, the more you study history, and I think this is something you learn as a student of history, but I think, you know, working with and studying under Kurush, who talks in, and for those of you who don't follow Kurush Dalal, please go and do, because it's a waterfall of knowledge that you will most definitely benefit from. But you know, when Kurush speaks, and he speaks about, like, oh, in thousand of year periods, like, I know conceptually that I, as one individual, on one hand, yes, I can change certain things in the world, but on the other hand, I'm not significant, and the story of my life is not particularly significant either, because several people will in some way, shape, or form be living the same story, right? So there's a sense of, like, your own self-importance not really being a thing in the story of the world. And that extends to a time frame as well. Like, understanding that an individual's understanding of the world is so limited, because we can't think in large frames of time. We can only think, you know, 20 to 50 years up and down from us. We can talk bigger than that, but we can't conceptualize bigger than that very easily. So I think the more you do that, the more you realize that we're very bound as human beings by our own limitations, and that extends to our food.
That's perfectly said. That's a great soundbite right there. Off script with Ragini and Keith. I'm enjoying this. I say we do a couple of quick fires and then on to the next one.
All right. Sounds like a plan.
You're up.
Okay. First question for you. Next regional South Asian cuisine that you really want to sink your teeth into?
Eat or study. I have always been very obsessed with Thai food. I just think the flavor profiles, the whys, you know, the questions to me are everything. Like, how did we get green curry? You know, and I know we touched on this a little bit in the turmeric episode. Shameless plug, if you haven't listened to the turmeric episode, go listen to that one. But I think the why in Thai food is really fascinating. It is such a delicious, delicious cuisine.
Amen.
And I really want to know more about the culture. So I definitely want to tackle that. I don't know if I'm ever going to be done, quote unquote, food from the subcontinent. So that would be my answer.
Yeah. Okay.
Quick fire for you. What? Man, there's like 8 million questions. What do you think is one of the most underrepresented states in terms of cuisine from the subcontinent? I know that's a hard one.
I think what's great about what's happening now on the subcontinent specifically is that so much regionality is coming to the forefront. That being said, I think for a long time we've looked at certain states from certain parts of the country, and I'm speaking specifically about India at this point, but I think it extends up to Pakistan as well, where there's been a tyranny of a Punjabi identity, especially in the northern Indian states and definitely in Pakistan. And that's been shaped by, it's all been shaped by what happened in 1947, right? That kind of two things happened. One, a lot of people were displaced, and two, both countries had to, or both groups of people had to establish their identity by new parameters, right? So I think that's something that now we're starting to challenge. And it wasn't helped by the fact that internationally, through colonial powers primarily, it was a North Indian, and by North Indian, it was very specifically this kind of hybrid Punjabi ish tomato onion heavy cuisine that largely made its way out. And then you can't talk about that without saying like, oh, but then that became even more convenient when it went to the West and certain things were more available than others. So they could kind of cookie cutter a business model. And then, you know, whether you were Bangladeshi or you were Bengali or you were Punjabi or you were Pakistani, whatever it is, you could come tap into that business model. And that's why we have this like model of Indian food through the, you know, early 20th century outside of India. So I think now that's starting to change, but it's new. And I mean, you and I have talked about it. There's still a lot of places that are doing like randomly named dishes that aren't actually what they say they are. Right. Sure. And you see that a lot. And to be fair, it's not just outside India. You see that in India as well. But I think one of the regional cuisines that hasn't really had its day in the sun outside of the subcontinent or even so much in it is definitely the foods of the Northeast. And for me, that's been a newer area of exploration as well. I've understood some things conceptually, but up until a couple years ago, it wasn't even that easy to access a lot of those foods. You know, now you can get like the Naga chili and the Puchalokia on Amazon in India, but like, until a couple of years ago, if you lived in another part of the country, where would you get that from? And if you lived in another part of the world, you know, good luck. So I think that's definitely been, and then there's so many, you know, the thing with the subcontinent is across from up north, you know, just under Afghanistan, all the way down to Kanyakumari, every 50 to 100 kilometers, it's a slightly different cuisine. So then the question becomes, where do you start and end the definition? Geographically, right? So I can't really answer. I mean, I feel like I could go on and on, but I think for me, a newer region of exploration has been the Northeast.
Oh, that's all. Yeah, I completely agree. I can't wait to dive in more. Mm-hmm. Every time I hear something new, I'm just like, oh. And that's why it's a lifetime of exploration.
Absolutely. And I think for anybody to say they've understood, it doesn't matter how long you've been doing it. There's just so much. Okay, next question for you. Who is one chef or one restaurant, either Indian, Pakistani, or Sri Lankan, or Nepali, or Bangladeshi, that you're really inspired by their work or have tried their food and love it?
Only one? Oh, man. The one is hard.
All right, top three.
Top three. I can do that. Niven Patel over at Ghee. Mm-hmm. I think that Chef Niven is constantly raising the bar. One of the things I love about him is he has like a farm, like right outside. He's farm to table India. Like, and it's so cool because awesome. I can relate a lot with that, obviously, with the farmer's dinner. I got to give it up to Chef Sahil over at Roux in Chicago. I'm really fortunate to talk to him quite a bit through Instagram, and I'm always just inspired by what they're doing there. And then, man, I could list about 20 right now in my head. I think another one. So there's the Gagans of the world who are clearly just in a class of their own. Mm-hmm. And man, I have so much love and respect for. But I think somebody who I think deserves a lot of praise and press throughout the course of this, I think the entire crew over at Damaka.
So that's in New York City?
Yeah, New York City. Here's why, and then I want to go through it. I want to camp out on this for a minute. I was very fortunate to be able to eat at the Maka probably a month or so ago. And I mean, the word means explosion. So you expect this is going to be a ton of flavor. They are, their slogan is unapologetically Indian. And I love that because in my food, I have this sense of rebellion. And every dish that I had from Chitan was absolutely mind-blowing. It was like being in a kitchen and somebody just cooking for you. There's no butter chicken on this menu. There is no insert generic thing here. This is all food directly from the heart and the soul. And that's hard to do in a place that responds very positively to the status quo. And so I have a lot of love and respect for what they're doing, and they deserve all of the accolades for that. So those are my three.
Nice.
Man,
I like that. Yeah.
last question. I say we do it this way. So I think that my last, man, this is tough. Because so since it's off script, we didn't plan any of this.
Yeah.
So it's like a little impromptu.
A
lot of impromptu. You're doing good. I think you're doing better than I am.
No. What?
Last question. I have a friend and he runs a podcast called Restaurant Unstoppable.
Okay.
And his name's Eric. And he has this question that he asks at the end. And I kind of want to butcherly ask this question because I think it's one of the best questions I've ever heard. If you knew tomorrow that you were going to die and all of your research, all of your restaurants, all of everything like that you did in your career, all of your food was going to be lost except three pieces of advice, what would they be? And I know it's such a loaded question.
Good God.
I've been in this podcast twice. And if you're listening to this, please go check out Restaurant Unstoppable. But I always think it's one of the best questions I've ever been asked.
Three pieces of advice.
Yep.
So I would say one, and this is something actually I use a lot, is remember that taste is subjective.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that I've trained myself now to try and look at. It's like, even if I don't like a flavor, it could still be incredible. And so what I need to do is look for how to appreciate that and understand that my taste has been shaped by my own cultural experience. So yeah, remember that taste is subjective is number one. Number two is, and it comes off of number one, is be curious about food, because food is, yes, food is absolutely function. Not everybody has the luxury of making food something enjoyable all the time. It is very functional a lot of the time. It is hard, and it's something of response. But there's so much joy in the process of food if you look for joy in that process.
Hmm.
Now, what I'm not talking about is, the elements of patriarchy and society that kind of bind people to processes. What I am talking about is remaining curious about the thing that sustains you every single day.
Hmm.
And what's the third one? Oh God, this is hard. I think the third piece of advice is, if you can, travel. If you can, and now, I genuinely think the internet is incredible for this, because you can vicariously, no, it's not a replacement, but you can vicariously visit pretty much any part of the world. And so the opportunity to learn is incredible. So however you can do it, get out there and talk to people, whether it's 5 miles away or 500 or 5,000, just get out there and try stuff and have that. So I think the thread that ties all three together is openness and curiosity.
Nailed it. I think you get last word there. That was really good. Yeah.
No, no, we're going to ask. No, come on. You got it.
I'm just being polite. All right. What do you got?
Same question. Three pieces of advice that you'd leave with.
But I've done this before. I've had this question.
Ugh, fine. I have to think again. All right.
I just don't want to cheapen the listening experience.
So go listen to Keith's talk on
Restaurant Unstoppable.
Unstoppable. I was like, unlimited. Restaurants Unstoppable. Go listen to both his episodes there for his answer to that question.
Yeah.
But for now, okay. My last question for you is, for somebody who doesn't have any experience with South Asian food, what is a good place? What's a good place to start exploring eating the cuisine from?
So if you've never really had experience with this first, I think it's important to actually go out and just try it. And I don't think in the beginning, people ask me all the time, they're like, do you even go and eat food from local places anymore? Yeah. I mean, Listen, I rail against buttered chicken a lot, but buttered chicken's freaking delicious, man.
There
like,
is.
I'm not going to lie. Like, naan is delicious. I just, when I make things, I just don't make it that. Like, you know, it's, naan is a celebration bread. It's not something that it's super common. So I think the first thing to do is go try. We experience so much when we open ourselves up to trying new cuisines that may seem different to us. I think it's pretty safe to say that most people start with chicken tikka masala. I think it's not an overly spiced dish. Notice I didn't say spicy dish. Mm-hmm. Spiced dish. I think from there, it's really important as you continue that journey to get out of your comfort zone. I thought you touched upon that well with the last answer. Like when we exist in our comfort zone, we actually don't grow. And in life, we're either growing or decaying. There's no kind of in between there. So typically...
Truth bomb.
To piggyback off what you said, like being open to trying new things, I think is really important. I don't really like olives.
I can't.
Yes, you can.
No. For someone who grew up in the Middle East, that is sacrilegious.
However, if you put an olive in front of me, I'll always try it because maybe that's the day I like it. And so I think it's important to open ourselves up to the possibility that we have no idea what the heck we're talking about. And so try new things. Don't fall in routines and traps. Just because butter chicken tastes good doesn't mean that the next thing isn't going to be even better. And... if you continue down that road, open yourself up to a lot of other potentials that maybe we have misconceptions. I hated fish growing up, and I worked in two different restaurants that were seafood based. later on, as I started to find other fish and started to find other means of preparation, I started to like it a lot more. So we don't know anything.
We know nothing.
And the entire premise of this episode has been, we don't know anything. thank you guys for listening. This is off script. This is the first one that we've done. This was fun.
This was a lot of fun. I hope you guys enjoyed it. And let us know what you thought of it. Let us know if you enjoyed this format where we pepper in, you know, a little bit of random conversation with our regular spice-based episodes.
And we'd love to take your questions too. Next time we do this, if you want to message Ragini or myself, we will take those questions, we'll save them, and we'll just throw them, like, I won't even tell you. I'll be like, hey, I got a question today, but that's all you'll know. And next time we do this, we'll get your questions as well in there. So thank you guys. Feel free to rate, subscribe, but you can only rate this 5 stars. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
Yeah,
only 5. Doesn't accept anything else.
Thank you guys. We'll talk to you soon.